This episode of the Serial Holic contains descriptions of disturbing graphic content, which may be offensive to some people. Listener discretion is advised. Serial killers.
I'm not a big serial killer, by the way. Eight people, that's nothing.
Don't you dare touch me! Murder.
I wouldn't let me go, no.
Because you'd kill again.
More than positive.
Mystery. I'm Dave Jari, and I am the Serial Holic. On this episode, I'd like to do things a little different. Guys, bear with me, but I would like to talk to the women for a minute. Ladies, I would like for you to take a moment and picture the man of your dreams. He is smart, handsome, strong, and charming. He's romantic, kind, devout, and hardworking. He is a great father, and your family and friends love him. Can you see him? He is just perfect. Now I'm going to tell you that the man you just envisioned is callous, a narcissist, a liar, a manipulator, a rapist, and a serial killer. Your entire life comes crashing down because the man you envisioned was nothing but a cold-blooded killer and you were just a pawn. A cover story for him to go about his murderous ways. Pretty shitty, huh? This episode, we are going to take a step away from the usual stories and take a look at the unspoken victims these psychopaths left behind to pick up the pieces of their shattered lives. Some of these women change their names and now live their lives in obscurity, while others bear their emotional wounds for all to see. But they all have one thing in common. The reality that the love of their life was a monster. Men who were incapable of truly reciprocating their love and destroyed their lives in the process. One has to wonder, though, throughout their relationships, were they really that naive to believe the lies that they were being told? Is love really that blind? You be the judge.
There have now been a total of 7 such killings since 1990.
Detectives say DNA collected from all 9 bodies matches that of this man, Robert Lee Yates.
For Linda Yates, being married for 26 years had its ups and downs. She had separated from her husband, Robert Yates, a transport pilot in the U.S. Army, twice during this time. The first time, because she learned Robert had drilled a hole in the attic wall so he could spy on the neighbors having sex. The second time, she took her children and left town. They remained separated for a year and a half until pressure from the children for reconciliation forced her to move back to Spokane, Washington. The romance was over, but she felt she had to do what was right by her children. What followed was nothing short of bizarre. For years, Linda was responsible for ensuring the bills were paid, and suddenly, Robert was throwing the bills into the fireplace. This began to pique her curiosity. She got a hold of a credit card statement and noticed there were charges to Al's Spa Tub, a seedy motel with jacuzzi tubs where they charge you by the hour. Linda confronted Robert and asked him if he was having an affair. He claimed that he went to the hotel because a tub relaxes muscles after working 12-hour shifts. Her suspicion didn't wane, however. Robert would tell Linda he was going hunting, but he would always be wearing cologne and nice clothes. If she thought that adultery was the worst of their problems, she was wrong. Robert became more and more shady. During an event for the Army, friends of Robert were surprised to learn that he was married. He was known to be flirtatious with women and would introduce himself as James Bond. Robert had drained the savings account after numerous ATM withdrawals, and things began to cool in the bedroom, with Robert claiming that he was impotent. Linda attributed his impotence to stress, but noticed that he kept buying violent orgy films and even asked her if she would like to explore a swinger lifestyle. But that's not all. He came home one day and the back seat in a family van was soaked in blood. The whole family saw this, and Robert said it was from a dog that he had hit and taken to the vet. Strange happenings continued to build up, and whether she cast them aside because of love, for the children, or for stability, she never would have imagined what the truth was about to reveal. Robert was arrested in 2000. She was confused as to why the police had come to search her home. That is, until the police discovered the body of Melody Murfin buried in the backyard just outside their bedroom window. In all, Robert had been convicted of 2 murders in 1975, 1 in 1988, and 10 murders in the late 90s. He is currently the main person of interest in 3 other murders, as well as an attempted murder.
Remember when he came home that night and he said he hit a dog and there was blood all over the back of the van?
Yeah, I remember asking him about it. I was like, what happened there? Oh, I accidentally ran into a dog and I had to set it on the back of, you know, there was a fold-out bed and I had to set it there and take it to the vet. I saw the blood, the stain.
It was on the back of the van, in the back seat of the van.
I just turned around in the middle, one of the middle chairs that were in the van, and I was like, what's that spot from? And that's what his excuse was about the dog getting hurt and it was really bloody. That's what he told me. And he said, I just couldn't get all the blood out. I tried and it still stained and it's good. And I remember the smell too. I remember the nasty, there was a smell. It didn't go away. It was just permanently on that. To know I was right there where he had laid a body, it was just disturbing.
July 1982, a woman's body is found in the Green River. Her name, Wendy Caulfield. No one knew it then, but she was the first victim of a brutal serial killer. 4 more women's bodies turned up in August. They'd been strangled. Most of them worked the streets around the SeaTac Strip. By the late 80s, more than 50 women were either dead or missing, but the identity of their killer remained a mystery.
Judith Mawson was deeply in love with her perfect husband. He would go out of his way to make her smile every day, so when police told her that her handsome, polite husband had been arrested for 70 murders, her world came crashing down. Her husband was none other than Gary Ridgway, the Green River Killer. How? She wondered. But then she looked back to a moment when she went to his house for the first time, and what she saw was odd. His house had all the carpets removed, and the bedroom had nothing but a box spring and a mattress. Gary explained to her that the previous tenants had damaged the carpets, and his ex-girlfriend took the furniture. She believed him at the time, but 16 years later, she learned the truth. He removed everything from his house because it was all soaked with blood from the numerous victims he had there. She recalls meeting Gary in a bar, and he was nothing short of a gentleman. He treated her extremely well and was always very affectionate with her. They had dated for 2 years and lived together for 1 before they decided to get married. Seems like an ample amount of time to learn if your significant other is a homicidal maniac. Judith says that they had an ordinary life. Gary would go to work during the week and on weekends they would go camping or go to yard sales. Nothing gave her the impression that he was what he was. It was rare that Gary wouldn't be home when he should have been. On occasion, he would leave real early or arrive late, but it was always something that had to do with work, or so she was told. When she found out that the love of her life was a serial killer, she fell into a downward spiral as the news hit her like a ton of bricks. She changed her name, her hair color, and buried herself in alcohol and pills. Now sober with a new identity, She has found some solace knowing that during her time with Gary Ridgway, his killing wasn't as frequent, as there were only 4 murders while they were together. So in essence, her love and Gary saved lives.
I was still in just such denial. Then I felt the anger that he had sex with someone else, that he hurt me. He betrayed me. He said he did not do anything with those women. But then when I found the condoms and stuff, then I realized that he did. Oh, I'd say, why, you son of a bitch, why did you do this to me? Why did you put me through all this?
What's good, everybody? This is Dave. I'd like to invite you to become a serialholic by joining Patreon. Lots of great perks are available, including a free gift, exclusive chat group, monthly AMAs, and much more depending on the tier you select. Join me now by going to patreon.com/theserialholic. That's patreon.com/theserialholic. Thank you all for your continued support. Now back to the episode.
John Gacy, a man who liked to put on a clown suit and entertain children. Now he is charged with one murder, and the police have found, at last count, 27 bodies buried under his house and garage, and 2 more in a nearby river.
For some of us, being married to someone who has an ex-spouse can be difficult. But when they have also been convicted of sodomizing a teenage boy, you're destined to be in for a rude awakening. This was the case for Carol Huff when she married John Wayne Gacy in 1972, exactly around the time he went from a child rapist to a sadistic serial killer. Even though Carol was well aware of Gacy's past conviction, she believed he was reformed. So much so that she entrusted him to be around her 2 daughters. Things began to take a turn, though. John began bringing home teenage boys to hang out and do odd jobs around the house. One in particular lived with Carol and John for some time. Then came the smell, the awful, putrid odor of rotting flesh that spread throughout the house. Carol would press Gacy about where the smell could be coming from. His response? He had recently killed a bunch of rats in the crawl space below their home. Now, I have been married before, and I know damn well my wife at the time wouldn't just let that be, especially if the odor constantly lingered. But for Carol, she accepted this answer and continued to live with the smell. Then came the news. Teenage boys from their neighborhood went missing or were found dead, one right after the other, including the young man that had lived with Carol and John. By 1975, their relationship was in a spiral. Although Gacy came across as an upstanding member of their community, inside the home, he was anything but. He was short-tempered and abusive with Carol, and eventually told her that he was bisexual. From that moment, they stopped having sex. Gacy began staying out at all hours of the night, and their home became cluttered with homophobic pornography. And the smell. The smell was still ever present. In 1976, Carol had enough and filed for a divorce, but not because she had thought he had reverted back to his old ways. She was just tired of his tirades and lack of respect for her. It wasn't until 2 years later, in 1978, when John Wayne Gacy was arrested for the kidnapping and murder of a 15-year-old boy, that she would learn of what he was really up to, and the realization that the smell coming from their basement wasn't from dead rats, but from the decaying bodies of nearly 30 young men.
John Wayne Gacy was pronounced dead at 12:58 a.m.
He got a much easier death than any of his victims. In my opinion, he got an easier death than he deserved. But the important thing is that he paid for his crimes with his life.
Mm-hmm.
The BTK murder mystery may be nearing an end.
That's right. Wichita police and city leaders confirming today that a person of interest taken in for questioning yesterday is, in fact, BTK.
Paula Rader was happily married for 34 years. Like Judith Mawson, Paula found the man of her dreams. Polite, respectable, a great father and husband, and president of their local church. She would have never fathomed that her husband, Dennis Rader, would be the person who was responsible for inflicting fear in the community for over 30 years and would become known as the notorious BTK. Not that there weren't any clues. Dennis Rader liked to taunt the police and media, often writing letters and making 911 calls to report his murders, and it wasn't kept from the public. The news would often replay his 911 confessions and even displayed his letters. One would think this would have raised a red flag, especially if you spent every day and night with the person responsible. It did, sort of. While watching the evening news with Dennis one night, they displayed one of BTK's letters. Paula mentioned to Dennis that BTK had the same writing as him, to which he replied, "Oh, really, honey? What a coincidence." Another aha moment occurred shortly after the murder of Shirley Relford, which was all over the news. Paula came across a poem Dennis had written that went into detail about the murder of Shirley. When she questioned him about it, Rader would explain that it was for a class he was taking at Wichita State University. The police would soon receive this very poem from BTK titled, "Shirley Locks." In Paula's defense, it wasn't like Dennis was consistently doing things to raise suspicions. The BTK murders were sporadic, to say the least. There were six in 1974, two in 1977, and one each in 1985, 1987, and 1991. And then, silence. It wasn't until 2004 when police heard from BTK again. Dennis Rader's alter ego couldn't contain himself. After a story aired about the 30th anniversary of the unsolved Otero murders, many thought BTK had died or was too old, explaining why 13 years of silence had passed. This enraged him, and he sent 11 communications to media outlets along with items that he collected from his victims. His arrogance is what led to him being caught. For Paula, her entire world exploded. She was home the day he was arrested. She had made lunch for her and her husband, and she waited patiently for him to arrive, but Dennis wasn't coming through the door. Instead, police burst through with guns drawn and a search warrant. A week later, their lunch still sat uneaten at the table, because after that day, Paula never stayed at the house again.
And then when I went back, Josephine had woke back up.
What did you do then?
And I took her to the basement and eventually hung her.
Are you hung her in the basement?
Yes, sir.
Did you do anything else at that time?
Yes, I had some sexual fantasies. But that was after she was hung.
Bundy is being guarded in a second-floor cell and last night was taken out for another session with Tallahassee Detective Sergeant Ben Rosar. "We've heard his life story," said Rosar. "He's telling us everything, but what we want to know, I'm holding my breath." What they want to know about is the January 15th strangling of two co-eds and the beatings of three others here at the Chi Omega sorority house on the Florida State University campus.
It was in October of 1969 when 24-year-old Elizabeth Klepfer, a divorced mother of one, and a friend went to the Sandpiper Tavern in Seattle, Washington for a girls' night out. It was just an ordinary night, until across the room was a man she instantly locked eyes with. She went to the jukebox to play a song when the man took her coin and chose the song. He introduced himself as Ted, and he asked her to dance. Her entire world changed from that moment forward. Her relationship with Ted Bundy was straight out of a fairy tale. He was charming, romantic, passionate, loving, and he was great with her daughter, quickly accepting her as his own. The chemistry between them was intense. For Elizabeth, this was a match made in heaven, but not for long. It didn't take long for Elizabeth to start noticing strange items around Ted's apartment. She found plaster of Paris, crutches, a hatchet, which were easily explained away by Ted. The plaster of Paris? You'd never know when you're going to break a leg. The crutches? They were left behind by my landlord. The hatchet? I needed to cut down a tree for my parents. She also found women's underwear and gas receipts showing he had taken long road trips without her knowledge. When Elizabeth pressed Bundy about this, he replied, "If you ever tell anyone about this, I'll break your fucking neck." Their relationship was a roller coaster, to say the least. 4 months after first meeting, they applied for a marriage license. Perhaps a blessing in disguise, Bundy used this as another in a long line of emotional abuse. After an argument, Bundy grabbed the marriage license and ripped it up in front of Elizabeth, and not long after, she became pregnant. Bundy expressed his enthusiasm, but not because a bundle of joy was on its way, because of his ability to produce a child. He convinced Elizabeth that this was not the right time to have a baby. She needed to work to put him through law school. So Elizabeth made an appointment to end the pregnancy. While she had her suspicions of Ted's infidelity, it wasn't until she saw a news report of two women who had gone missing from Lake Sammamish State Park. In the news report, one of the girls was witnessed talking to a man named Ted, who had a cast on his arm and drove a Volkswagen Beetle, the same car Bundy drove. She recalled the plaster of Paris and the hatchet that he kept in his car and reported her suspicions to the police, who dismissed her claims. Bundy eventually moved away to Utah to attend law school, and I'm sure you know what happens next. Shortly after he was arrested and charged with the murders of two women at Florida State University, she was done with the lies. Through a telephone conversation, Bundy confessed to her. She asked him if there was ever a time that he tried to kill her. Bundy said yes, one night when she was sleeping. He closed the flue to the fireplace and the room began to fill with smoke. He placed wet towels around the doors and he left. She remembered that night and recalled, "I had prayed for so long to know, and now the answer killed a part of me." Elizabeth cut off all ties with Ted and eventually wrote a book about her life with him. She now lives in obscurity and wants nothing to do with the public eye.
He ever tried to kill me, and he told me at one incident that he did.
What was that?
Oh, I used to sleep on a hide of bed by the fireplace in the living room, and he closed the damper. I was drunk that night, and closed the damper. He put towels under the door, and then he left. And he told me that he'd been really trying hard to control the sickness, and that he'd been staying off the streets and trying to be normal, and that it just happened that I was there when he felt it coming on, and that he wanted to kill me that night.
We could use all of the cliches, like love is blind, ignorance is bliss, or hindsight is 20/20. But what we have to understand is that these women are only guilty of loving the wrong man. Men who are experts at deceit and manipulation, and while it's easy to judge after the fact, these women were victims in their own right. Their lives tragically altered forever. This episode of The Serial Holic was written and produced by me, Dave Jari. Music for this episode was composed by myself, Jameson Mills, Arn Anderson, and Knights of More. Please follow me at theserialholic.com, where you can read my profile, connect with me on Facebook and Instagram, and chat with me on Messenger. While you're there, don't forget to check out my store where you can purchase Serial Holic swag. Just click on the shopping cart. As always, stay tuned for more episodes, and thank you for listening.